Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
Good afternoon and welcome to this afternoon's episode of Cresta in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. In this hour of today's program, we will be talking with Robert Kloska about an issue that plagues Christianity constantly. It's been a continual issue throughout the entirety of Christian history, and this is the problem of pain. We will discuss this with Robert, but particularly with the perspective of being grateful for the reality of pain. Robert will share a personal testimony that will highlight just how painful his own recovery and acceptance of God's will in his life is like. And then from there, we will be talking about institutional diversity and identity in Catholic education. And our guest for that will be Terence Sweeney. And in particular, we'll talk about this notion of bland sameness. In our interest of pushing forward diversity, in our interest of pushing forward these notions of differences that ought to be celebrated, unfortunately, what winds up happening is that we're creating multiplicity with no real distinction of oneness. Now, what that means, Terence will walk us through, and we'll be able to dialogue that deeper. But what we want to highlight here is that we were not made to all be different and therefore the same. Instead, we have unique identities rooted in our being created in the image and likeness of God. And so the differences that separate us become the things that ought to be celebrated in reunification, in uniting us, in celebrating the great creative grandeur of the Father. Now, talking about suffering then, throughout history, mankind has gone through this reality of suffering. In 1984, John Paul II penned an apostolic letter called Salvifici Dolores, and in it he highlights how suffering is in fact salvific. It is redemptive, which is a very painful thing to admit when it is a human person that is going through the pain. No one knows the suffering of a person outside of that person himself. Yet, humanly speaking, our suffering cries out for a meaning that is greater than our natural limited life. More on this later. For now, let's take a look at the headlines.
Thanks, Marcus. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Wednesday, May 22nd. It's the Feast of St. Rita of Cassia. Today's news brought to you by Ave Maria University. Your vocation location is at avemaria.edu. Pope Francis will be making a trip to Luxembourg and Belgium in September. He'll stop in Luxembourg on the 26th before heading to Belgium, where he'll stay there until the 29th. The Pope is also set to travel to Indonesia, Papua New Guinea, and Singapore in that month. The Biden administration is announcing another round of student debt relief.
The Department of Education says it's forgiving $7.7 billion in student loans for over 160,000 borrowers in an effort to reduce the burden of education debt on U.S. households. The debt relief includes over $5 billion for those pursuing public service loan forgiveness and about $2 billion for students enrolled in income-driven repayment plans. Including today's debt relief, the Biden administration has so far forgiven about $167 billion in student aid. I'm Lisa Taylor.
House Speaker Mike Johnson wants to impose sanctions on the International Criminal Court for seeking arrest warrants for Israeli leaders over the war in Gaza.
The ICC has chosen to target Israel with baseless and illegitimate arrest warrants, and it's attempting to equate Israel's just war for its existence with the horrific acts of the October 7th massacre.
Johnson telling reporters today Congress is reviewing aggressive legislation that would result in sanctions if the ICC moves forward with arrest warrants for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The ICC is pushing for arrest warrants for Netanyahu along with leaders of Hamas for alleged war crimes in Gaza. And Ireland, Norway, and Spain are moving forward with recognizing Palestine as a state, igniting criticism from Israeli officials. Irish Forest Minister Michael Martin says the Palestine's right to self-determination, peace, dignity, and statehood must be vindicated. From your AveMariaRadio.net news desk, I'm Steve Clark.
Good afternoon, I'm Marcus Peter for Cresta in the Afternoon. How much worse off would we all be without physical pain? And yes, I said that right. How much worse off would we all be without physical pain? As counterintuitive as it sounds, pain is in fact a boon, a blessing. It's our friend. Pain is a mechanism that warns us that something is wrong. 20 years ago, it was pain that made Robert Kloska go see a doctor, who was able to catch his growing cancer before it was too late. Robert shares more on why he is grateful for that pain and why he is grateful that he went through that. Bob Kloska, he is a husband and father of 5 children and armed with a rosary and degrees from the University of Notre Dame and Franciscan University of Steubenville. He once founded a Catholic radio station, worked as a high school theology teacher, a college philosophy professor, a liturgist, an RCIA director, a speaker, expedition leader to Africa, and is now a banker at Notre Dame Federal Credit Union, the largest Catholic-oriented credit union in America. Check out his private backyard pub, St. Peter's Pub, on Facebook and Instagram. Bob, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me on, Marcus.
Well, your article was intriguing and, frankly, quite the jarring wake-up call. And I must start off by saying I don't know a single person, personally, who would say, thank God I'm going through pain. And yet, like St. James, James in his epistle, he says, count you for joy when you're faced with trial. It sounds like you're celebrating the fact that pain is a good thing. So let's start there.
Well, about 21 years ago, I was diagnosed with my first of 3 bouts of cancer. I've actually had 3 rounds of cancer, a heart attack, many chronic illnesses, 30 surgeries, wow, countless hospitalizations. But all my problems physically started in May of 2003. And it was a feeling of suffocation and like a noose being tied around my neck. That was the sensation that got my attention and made me go to see a doctor. Well, when I went to see the doctor, they quickly did tests and they found a large tumor growing near my heart that was closing off artery, and it was creating pressure in my head. Well, because of that intervention and 6 months of chemotherapy and 6 weeks of daily radiation, I've lived 21 more years. So I would hate to think of a world where you didn't have a warning system. And the nature and one's body gives us a beautiful warning system that something is wrong.
Right. And Bob, I mean, reading your story, reading your article, it's very clear that God was trying to tell you something, and considering how much you've gone through and that he still keeps you here, it's very clear that he wanted you to catch this, and pain became the medium, if you will, or at the very least the modus, through which he communicated this to you. So you're grateful for that, but no one, least of all you, is going to say, therefore I am celebrating the fact that I was going through pain. I mean, that the pain that you underwent was enormous.
It's true, but, you know, I think it can be overblown. I come from a tradition, a Catholic tradition, where pain can be sanctified. And you read about that and you think about that in theory, and it takes an event like I just described to make you put that theory to test in the practical laboratory of life. And it's true. It's more true than I ever would have thought. when experiencing pain in the darkness and discomfort of hospitals and surgery rooms and recovery places, I also have experienced some of the most intense joy of my life.
Mm-hmm.
But the joy, it's not a giddiness, it's not a, hey, you know, telling a lot of jokes, but it's a sort of happiness that comes from feeling like you're really close to God.
Right.
And nothing, there's nothing comparable to that. The offering of one's suffering can be a beautiful experience, and I consider it a blessing. So I feel bad when I hear other people going through it. I don't sit there and just tell them to suck it up and sanctify it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, I knew what I was called to do, and it's been a beautiful thing. Another thing I would say is when suffering and attempting to accept and transcend that suffering and send it back as a gift, it's like the pain is the messenger. Something is wrong. And that could be, in my case, we're talking about physical pain, which might just be a mere metaphor for spiritual, psychological, emotional pain.
Mm-hmm.
But when the pain comes, and instead of repelling it and raging against it, if you accept it and bless it and send that messenger back with the message of love, it can just be a very powerful, satisfying blessing in life. And that's
right.
Been my experience. Yeah.
And I'm really glad you shared that. And so, as I'm doing this live program right now, last Thursday, my bride and I just had our third born, Bernadette Rose, and I marvel every time I watch my bride go through this. But she lays lays her life and her body down on the line for the sake of our children. And I watch these doctors and nurses prod at her and poke at her and do all sorts of painful things to her in the effort to bring her eventual healing. And as a husband, you feel completely useless to alleviate that pain. So, you know, like, we become painfully aware that watching a loved one go through pain is in and of itself a kind of suffering that is begging to be sanctified as well.
That's right. And there is a sense of helplessness. I know exactly. I have 5 kids. I've watched my wife go through that. I would also say that in the pain, and then watching that child emerge, mm-hmm. was also something, you know, we overuse the word awesome, but full of awe and
right.
reverence and beautiful. Even in the pain, there is something beautiful about the childbirth. Now, of course, I hope it goes easy for my wife, and we had one of our 5 where she had virtually no pain, and I'm very happy for that.
Oh, wow.
You know, in the other 4, especially if the person suffering wallows in self-pity
mm-hmm.
and rages against the pain and feels sorry for oneself, that the helplessness that bystanders feel is enormous, and it almost drives you to despair.
Right.
But if you have a wife like mine who is kind of heroic, mm-hmm. and she didn't like it, and she didn't want it, and in fact dreaded it, but embraced it and transcended it. And you did not sense that this poor woman was suffering in vain, but rather suffering for something indescribably great. Mm-hmm. It is actually a blessing to everyone around the sufferer when the sufferer embraces and transcends their pain. I've been in therapy, IV therapy rooms with chemotherapy patients, and it's really interesting. You can go two ways very quickly with cancer. You can kind of get this peaceful heroism and go for the transcendence, or you can just wallow in the why me's and mm-hmm. self-pity. And that is a poison. And Marcus, it leads to death. The people right. that take that attitude not only physically die, but they manage to make everyone around them that cares about them feel even worse. And so when I was challenged with my own suffering, I wanted to make sure that my loved ones and my friends didn't have to suffer any more than they were already suffering watching mm-hmm. me suffer, you know? So it's a gift to others when you're in pain to not dwell unnecessarily in the self-pity.
So that's why you write that compared to mental, emotional, and spiritual pain, physical pain is not so bad, because the kind of damage that those other three pains can cause is deeper and longer lasting.
Yes, and I feel like I've been given a privileged position mm. in life, which is a gift. I have experienced what I consider the greatest imaginable amount of pain possible. I don't know if you know what a bone marrow biopsy is.
Yep.
But it's a corkscrew that's screwed into your bone like a wine bottle, and you take it out.
Yep.
I've had 19 of those.
Bob, I'm yep. so sorry. I'm going to have to cut you off there because we're hitting a hard break. My guest, Bob Kloska, husband and father of five, author of this wonderful article, Thank God for Pain. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter for Cresta in the Afternoon.
The Catholic Church teaches that Jesus Christ is literally and wholly present, body and blood, soul and divinity, under the appearances of bread and wine. St. John the Apostle records the John chapter 6 Bread of Life discourse, in which Jesus states that his flesh is true food and his blood true drink. Who better to understand John's writings and subsequent teachings than a disciple and student of John, St. Ignatius of Antioch? In his letter to the Smyrnians in 110 AD, Ignatius writes, "I have no taste for corruptible food, nor for the pleasures of this life. I desire the bread of God, which is the flesh of Jesus Christ. And for drink, I desire his blood, which is love incorruptible." The Catholic Church absolutely follows St. John and St. Ignatius in taking Jesus at his word. Examining the truths of the Catholic faith, this is faithforensics.org.
Why should we do no work on the Sabbath as the third commandment demands? The Catholic Catechism reminds us that in 6 days the Lord God made the heavens and the earth and the seas and all that is in them. On the seventh day he rested, thereby blessing and hallowing the Sabbath. The Sabbath is also a memorial of Israel's liberation from Egypt. The Sabbath is a sign of God's irrevocable covenant with Israel. Thus, the day is to be set apart as holy and for the praise of God, his work of creation, and his saving action on behalf of Israel. God set a model for human action. If the Almighty Creator could take a day off for rest and refreshment, so should his creatures. For Christians, Sunday replaces Sabbath observance because it is the day Jesus rose from the dead and ushered in the new creation. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Ave Maria School of Law is the Roman Catholic law school in the United States. Consistently ranked in the Princeton Review as one of the best and most conservative law schools, as well as pre-law's most devout law school. Ave Maria School of Law provides a traditional legal education while emphasizing how the law intersects with the Catholic intellectual tradition and natural law philosophy. Ave Maria School of Law, unabashedly Catholic, consistently excellent. For more information, visit avemarialaw.edu.
This program is brought to you in part by Charity Mobile, a proud partner of Ave Maria Radio for over 15 years. Charity Mobile is the pro-life cell phone company and has sent nearly $2 million to thousands of pro-life charities. 4G LTE coverage is available nationwide, and 5% of your monthly plan price goes to your favorite pro-life charity. A video introduction is available at CharityMobile.com. Charity Mobile, everyday living, effortless giving. CharityMobile.com.
Cresta in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
This program brought to you in part by the town of Ave Maria, Florida.
Ave Maria, a big kind of small town. A golf cart friendly, ride your bike everywhere kind of town with something for everyone. Resort style amenities, two golf courses, shopping, and dining in our town center. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at the core of the community and a wide range of homes to meet your family's needs. Visitors are welcome. More information can be found at avemaria.com. Ave Maria, a big kind of small town.
Good afternoon and welcome back to Cresta in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. Bland sameness. It's a problem that's afflicting much of societal life today. Wherever one turns these days, it is hard to miss some kind of institutional narrative proclaiming a commitment to diversity. So you see this in businesses, in the military, in churches, and especially in universities, which all claim to be diverse places. Behind these identical claims to difference, there is a rush towards sameness, a rush that is particularly acute at the university level. We are joined by Terence Sweeney to talk about this more. Terence is assistant teaching professor in the Honors Program in Humanities Department at Villanova University. His work centers on Augustine, but extends to medieval thought, philosophical theology, and political theory. Terence, great to have you in the program.
It's great to be here.
So I read your article with significant interest, and I was going to make a little wisecrack about you being an Augustinian. I was going to tell you it's not your fault you're not a Thomist.
Well, Thomas was a great Augustinian himself, and a great devotee of the father of the church. So these things are all
Yeah, no, you're completely right. I don't even know why I take that stab at different schools. I'm an Augustinian, Ratzingerian, Thomist, scripture guy, what have you, right? Like, yeah. We just grow to love all of the riches of the intellectual tradition. So I want to start by talking about this term that you've coined, bland sameness, because for want of a better term, this is encapsulating what we are seeing in the public sphere. In our quest to all proclaim diversity and to all show ourselves as celebrating differences, we wind up becoming exactly the same. And so we've become this grand glob of nothing. So just talk to us about that.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, part of the tension of thinking through this is, you know, about unity and difference in any culture. I mean, United States motto, famously, pluribus unum, right? Out of many, one, right? So how do we think about this? But what happens sometimes, at least when you aim for a certain kind of vision of diversity, it kind of brings down actual, like, robust differences between us, which are real, you know, difference between different philosophies and religions. Kind of it eliminates that. You almost have a kind of vision where human diversity is merely different cuisines and what have you, which are nice. I like different cuisines. But it all kind of starts looking the same. So I was for a I worked at the University of Pennsylvania for a couple of years. But what they were saying about diversity was pretty much the same as what was being said at the state school and at a Catholic school. It's like, how do we allow the three different kinds of institutions to be different? And that's when you start seeing versions of kind of diversity that's actually much more interesting. One where we articulate why we believe certain things, why we act in certain ways, and argue about them sometimes because they're actually different, as opposed to some of the kind of more general, everybody saying the same thing, DEI or whatever the terminology is going to be, in a way that's, you know, in a lot of ways kind of boring.
Right. In a lot of ways, we've wind up falling into the mundane and the blasé in our great effort to be as inclusive and diverse. When everyone's calling out this thing, everyone is claiming to be this thing, well, then effectively none of us are really standing out and being different. I think about René Girard and his mimetic theory. We started off with this notion of mimetic desire. They're inclusive. I want to be inclusive too. And then there's this notion of conflict. We develop some scapegoats within the society. And in the public sphere right now, it's unfortunately particular members of the ethnic group. And then now, at this point, this cover-up resolution, we're all equally inclusive. And really, this isn't benefiting us in the long run.
Yeah, and of course, of note, I mean, I think a great expression of this is Pope Benedict's dictatorship of relativism,
right.
The sense that, like, yeah, what you get here is a certain kind of appeal to diversity, but if one doesn't actually mimic that appeal to diversity or raises questions, critiques, one has to be kind of, you know, driven out. That's sort of like, you know, I definitely feel this in the academic world of moments of like threat and concern about the security of my position if I say certain things, right, that, you know, would kind of violate the diversity dynamic. Well, that's a kind of strange kind of diversity where, like, well, I don't know if I should say that, something that is different, because I might run afoul. And that's that economy. Relativism is a profoundly uninteresting intellectual account. I mean, you know, if you're teaching an ethics class, you have to kind of get rid of it from students so they can actually do the interesting work of thinking through rival moral claims. Because relativism is bland. It actually pulls down differences. But also, as Benedict, you know, so wisely pointed out, it's not as tolerant as it claims to be.
That's right.
And thus, people get excluded.
Right. The only absolute that relativism will tolerate is itself.
Right.
Going from there, you highlight Saint Bonaventure University and this unfortunate distillation of this great course on Franciscan spirituality and thought, and we're seeing more and more universities move down this ilk in the interest of developing what one would typically classify as the servile arts, degrees that lead to employment. By itself, not bad, but we're losing sight of some great treasures in the process.
Yes, I'm a big fan of employment for myself and for others, but you know, I think, you know, what employment is for something, right? So it's for our basic human needs, but it's also to create the possibility of a fuller life, for human flourishing in a really robust way. So when we're learning, I mean, I want college students to learn all kinds of skills, writing, speaking, defending positions, learning how to do an accounting spreadsheet or do good work as an engineer or a nurse. That's great. First of all, I want good engineers to build the hospital. I want good nurses to work there. All good stuff. But, like, towards what end? That's the work of a core at a university. It's like, okay, what is the good life? What is the highest end of the human person? Is that highest end rightly called God? If so, is that thinking through these things so that I, as a nurse or an accountant or an engineer or, in my case, a philosopher, can really live my technical skills towards those ends. And that's why, I mean, when a university is working really well, you know, those first couple of years, you're really delving into the fundamental questions of human life within the context of a tradition, you know, at Villanova, Augustinian, at St. Bonaventure, Franciscan, in order to kind of situate your life skills that you're going to be learning in your majors and minors.
Right. Right, and that fundamental question of the bonum vitae, or vivi bonum vitae, living the good life, is a question that plagues the entirety of humanity throughout the entirety of their life. Until they find that answer, it will render a person restless. So even a person with the most employable of degrees, who winds up in the most lucrative of career positions, will wind up constantly seeking the answer to that question. So, at least in the academic forum, there should be an avenue for the answering of it.
Absolutely. I mean, schools do a number of things, but it's about to as adults, they can look to what they learned, share it with others, and kind of do the kind of shared work of living out the fundamental orientation of the human person, which is, ultimately is communion with God and neighbor. And kind of shaping that in college is really key. Obviously, people encounter this intellectual formation in different ways. Not everyone goes to college. Augustine likes referring to churches as the great lecture halls where people are able to encounter the truth. Right? So obviously, church is the most important place we do that. But universities are a part of that. And if we give up on that, this is one of the things, if we stop doing it, there are some places picking up the slack, of course, but universities bring a unique capacity to do this, and we give it up, it's going to be hard for it to live on. Just as if Catholic universities give up on the Catholic intellectual tradition, UPenn and Penn State, they're not going to do it. So if we stop doing it, no one does.
That's right. That's right. And if we were to start and or continue doing it, what we would wind up doing is instilling the culture with a tremendous amount of richness. Because like you mentioned, as Villanova does this through the Augustinian perspective, St. Bonaventure through the Franciscan perspective, Ave through the Thomistic perspective, all of these great minds precede us in having examined the question of the bonum vitae. And taking it from a natural philosophy perspective into the science of divine revelation, sacred doctrine, what we come to see is that the good life ultimately culminates in the person of Jesus Christ. And the way we get there is what enriches the society. And if we don't put out people who are able to think their way there and live their way there, we run the risk of distilling society into this poor carbon copy of what it ought to be.
Right. And I think, you can see that. I think it's something fitting of that. The term for people who are becoming unchurched is the nuns, and they sign the form saying they have religion none, and there's something about that that's already kind of like structurally bland, so in that world, like we live in a world with a lot of things are very same and uniform, and some of the things are like difference is not always good, and unity is good, so we want both. But like what we should be offering in Catholic universities, Catholic schools, Catholic institutions of all kinds, is that saving difference,
right.
And that introduction into what it means to enter into communion with the God who fathers forth all diversity in his work of creation.
So you highlight the fact that Gravissimum Educationis mentions this specifically, and it calls it the proper task of the Catholic education institution. So give us an idea of what that looks like.
Yeah, this is a text often forgotten, including by people who claim to be great proponents of the Second Vatican Council, right? And it kind of sets forth what is the role of Christian education. And it's a matter of grave concerns, very important, right? And of course, the text notes, as any reasonable text would say, there's a lot of overlap between what a Catholic school is going to do and a secular school, right? Skill building, the pursuit of truth, right? There's really a lot of overlap. But part of what a Catholic school should be doing is, the formation of us as the baptized, right? So to become baptized is to enter into the life of Christ and to have the Holy Spirit beginning to grow in our hearts. So Catholic school should be fostering that, right?
We're
deep tradition, the sense that our ultimate destination is to be with God and to be divine ourselves in a very real way. So that's what we should be cultivating, that remarkable goal.
So, Terrence, we're going to pause right there because we're hitting a hard break, but we'll continue this conversation with Terrence Sweeney, assistant teaching professor at Villanova University, and we're talking about institutional diversity and identity in Catholic education. I'm Marcus Peter.
Support for this Ave Maria radio program comes in part by the non-for-profit St. Anthony Services. Are you shopping for mortgage products, Catholic investing, Catholic health, real estate, or estate planning? StAnthonyServices.org can help you find a Catholic professional for these needs. They regularly connect faithful citizens with faith-based professionals that share our Christian values. More information at StAnthonyServices.org or 877-LIFE-US1.
St. Therese once told her sister Celine that when we trust ourselves and not God, our soul becomes barren and incapable of virtue. Her remedy? External works of charity. We all try to do it on our own sometimes without asking for God's help. At St. Paul Evangelization, we suggest sharing the gospel with someone who needs it. Check out streetevangelization.com to find a team near you where you can share the love of Jesus. If there isn't one in your area yet, perhaps God is calling you to start a team in your city. To learn more, visit streetevangelization.com.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria Mutual Funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria Mutual Funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria Mutual Funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Underwritten in part by the following nonprofit.
Are you paying high prices with a traditional health insurance company that pays for things that violate your conscience? There's an alternative available. Solidarity HealthShare is a community of faithful individuals and families that never share into immoral medical services, all while saving you money with prices starting as low as $85 per month for singles and $512 for families. Never fund another abortion with your healthcare dollars. Call 844-313-4999 to learn more.
The following program is brought to you in part by MyCatholicWill.com. Surveys show that more than half of Americans do not have a will. At MyCatholicWill.com, it takes as little as 15 minutes to write your will and secure a legacy of faith. MyCatholicWill.com is the exclusive online destination for creating a Catholic will. The process of writing a will is simple and now more accessible than ever. MyCatholicWill.com, a legacy of faith for those you love.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
Isn't it awesome that we today do not recognize his presence in the Eucharist? Is it because we really don't go to him in humbleness of heart and say, Lord, I don't believe, help my unbelief. Lord, I want to see you. I want to recognize you. I cannot live without you. Are we saying that?
EWTN, live truth, live Catholic.
Does the fourth commandment only order us to honor our father and our mother? According to the Catholic Catechism, it also obliges us to give honor and respect to all whom for our good God has vested with his authority. Respecting the fourth commandment, says the Catechism, brings its own reward, not only with spiritual fruits, but temporal benefits of peace and prosperity, whereas failure to observe the commandment brings harm to individuals and communities. We are reminded that marriage and the family is ordered to the good of the spouses and the procreation and education of children. The Catechism states a man and a woman united in marriage together with their children is what forms a family. God instituted the human family when he created man and woman and instructed them to increase and multiply. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Good afternoon, and welcome back to Cresta in the Afternoon. My guest is Terrence Sweeney, assistant teaching professor in the Honors Program in Humanities Department at Villanova University. His work centers on St. Augustine, but it extends to medieval thought, philosophical theology, and pastoral and political theory, and we're talking specifically about institutional diversity and identity in Catholic education. So, Terence, when we left off earlier, we were talking about Gravissimum Educationes and its reminder, this very hardline nail in the coffin reminder that this is the proper function of a Catholic institution. Lose this and essentially lose the reason you exist. So let's talk about that.
Yeah, and I think it has a very strong sense as a text that what Catholic universities, when they live out their charism of the formation of the baptized through the intellectual life into kind of a fulfillment of that their baptismal promises, that it acts as a kind of transformative element in society. When we're actually teaching students into the Catholic intellectual tradition with its own proper diversity, we're acting as a kind of leavening agent in the broader culture by bringing forth fundamental Catholic views and also making it possible to kind of be engines of political justice and evangelization of the culture.
Right. And perhaps therein lies the problem. We often think about Catholic organizations of education, in this case, universities and even high schools. It's so easy to want to veer down the path of the college prep STEM model for anything before the tertiary level, and for the universities to be the employable institution, the institution that focuses on the STEM. When all of those are well and good, but when our gen eds are only merely peppered with a little bit of theology and philosophy, we're not really generating people who think well, that they may live the good life well. We're generating people who have a sprinkling of theology and philosophy, and we expect them to fend for their moral lives in the world after we set them off.
Yeah, I mean, I think I mentioned, you know, Fairfield University in the article in Connecticut, and you know, they had this description of their core as an opportunity for students to choose their own values and understanding of life. Now, in some sense, that's not wrong. I mean, ultimately, you know, as free beings, right? We have to kind of, you know, make the teachings of the church our own. But there's something about that that's totally wrong. But it does lend itself against that kind of blandness where, like, I, you know, you throw a few ideas at me when I'm 18 and now I'm going to choose my own values. Really what we want to do is help you discover reality. And then the work is hopefully, you know, in your own kind of character development, not only to discover reality, but to commit to it, you know, the reality of being as sourced from God and oriented towards return. And so that's what we should be really doing, so that, again, that your technical skills are ordered towards transformation of society. I mean, a lot of universities these days, Pope Francis is very popular at universities, but Francis wants us to evangelize. And
right.
Universities seem to be selectively picking some aspects of Francis's papacy. But what they should be doing is saying, wow, I mean, Francis thinks, I mean, his first major text is about evangelization. All right, well, how do we live that out in the way that's appropriate to universities, right? There's ways that wouldn't fit in university life and the ways that do. But the primary way is educating our young people so that they can bring the good news and give good reasons for it. I mean, the passage in St. Peter, we should always be prepared to offer an explanation for the reasons for our hope.
Right.
And, you know, a smattering here and there to students, I mean, we're never able to fully exhaust the reasons for our hope. I mean, God is inexhaustible. And yet, to give us a little bit of that ability to do that is really transformative. Not just for people who go on, like me, to kind of study this stuff for the rest of their life, but sometimes I think of my mother, went to a Catholic school, a Catholic college, worked as a banker her whole career. But she had, you know, I was probably mentioning something. She said, oh, I remember that from Aquinas. Like, man, that was, well, I'm not going to say how long ago. I'm not going to say my mother's age. but wow, you know, and, you know, that prepared her to raise her kids, to give us a sense of kind of the fundamental ordering of things, even if she hasn't read Thomas Aquinas directly since her college days.
Right. And there's a kind of repulsiveness, and I say this without vitriol, a real repulsiveness of the soul to this, not only relativism, but this great distillation, this great I once heard someone coin this as the heresy of low expectations to students who are coming in, as if they are only capable of understanding this much and no more. This philosophy of teach the lowest common denominator at all times, instead of challenging the liberal ethos of the intellect into the contemplation of the highest of truths, so that people like your mother, years and years after she's left university, probably what, 10, 20 years after she's left university, she's still able to think about the things that she read about Aquinas. And we've lost that. We've developed, as you mentioned, this relativistic system of education.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, for Aquinas, I mean, he talks about, like, according to natural law, when he's thinking about, you know, the good that humans are inclined to, one of them is the knowledge of the divine. We want that. And that is a remarkable thing about us. I mean, something worth spending a lot of time thinking about and praying about and being grateful for, that God made us to want to know God. There's nothing harder, more wonderful, more enriching to know than God. So allowing our education to say, okay, well, you need to know skills, you need to know, core facts, but then also allow it to exalt in the way that, like, yeah, but you're also going to have a chance to turn upward into the intellectual pursuit of God. And I think that's part of that. And to think that we can actually have some truth there, both in a natural way, through reason, and then, of course, in the fuller and richer way, in a supernatural way. But to realize, wow, I can actually articulate why a certain action is morally wrong or morally right. I can know that. I'm the kind of creature, the only kind in the material world that can do that. That's amazing.
Right.
And to give students that opportunity to say, I'm an accountant. I'm an engineer. I'm a plumber. And yet I am made for the knowledge of God and have a capacity to encounter the universe.
Right.
I don't know. I get excited about it.
Well, and professors like you are spearheading that charge, because behind that kind of ethos of education, a philosophy of education, is the notion that we want to raise saints. We don't want to raise plumbers and accountants and engineers. We want to raise saints who are accountants and saints who are philosophers and plumbers and so on and so forth. And when we keep in mind that fundamental teleology of the human person, and therefore the end of education, all of this falls into place.
Right. I think, you know, May 15th, I think, is the Feast of St. Isidore, who's a patron saint of gardeners. I deal with gardening, so I love Isidore. I mean, he had the science of the saints, the kind of the insight into God. And that's not just for the brilliant and great. It's for each and all. I mean, when Augustine has his arguments with some of the Platonists, Augustine's like, you guys are just jealous because Christianity is the access for wisdom for all people, not just right. for the kind of elite fancy PhDs or whatever. And so to kind of cultivate that so that all these careers and vocations and gifts and charisms from whether it's, you know, cleaning the streets to doing astrophysics are ways of giving greater glory to God. But if you forget that, the God and the glory part, then it's all just kind of ways of getting by.
Right.
We all need to get by, but life's a lot more important than just getting by.
That's right. So going back to exactly what you talk about in your article, instead of striving to be inclusive of diversity, what we ought to be pushing for are these objective transcendental truths and realities, first on the natural level, on the philosophical level, and then contemplating the theological revelation that we've received, and then we get the natural world thrown in its virtuous life. That, paraphrasing Lewis here, if you aim for heaven, you get earth thrown in. You aim for earth, you get neither.
Right, and so as I put it, you know, if we aim for diversity, we end up getting neither diversity nor unity. And so to kind of cultivate, I mean, these two metaphysical principles, as my students probably tire of hearing about, sameness and difference, but there to be a created thing is always to have a kind of play of sameness and difference. You and I are both human beings, right? So sameness, you and I have very different backgrounds, our lives are different, we live in different places, different. And so when we kind of cultivate both of those. And part of that, for me as a teacher, is is cultivating not everybody's views are equally valid. No, let's put together some different views, right? Explain why are they different, how are they different, and work through the relative strengths of these. I mean, this is the great medieval tradition of disputations. I mean, if you read the Summa Theologica, that's basically what it is, right? You get rival voices that Aquinas clearly takes seriously.
That's right.
And then the working through, and sometimes, you know, the beautiful thing is replies. It's funny, it's like, clearly he's learned something from this view that he doesn't agree with, right? Including, you know, when he's talking about proofs for God's existence, claim that God doesn't exist, and he's going to work through that. And so that's not relativism. That's like bringing together real difference. The difference between, you know, Christianity and Nietzscheism, the difference between different religious traditions, the strength, the values and insights of each, but then ultimately seeing, okay, what's the true? What's the answer to the human heart? That's the work of a classroom. And I love doing it. I just love doing it. I'm like, all right, we're going to meet Nietzsche and Pascal. They're both kind of like dark, moody thinkers. And like ultimately, in Pascal's account, do we see his account of heart and love as fundamentally like the rational force in our existence, or do we as a better answer than Nietzsche's kind of sense, it's all just raw will, with no truth or goodness at all? And let's work through that. And a student has to then, they've got to do that work. I help them. I can't do the work for them. And that's an education.
Exactly. And that's the end of a good education, that you are unafraid to engage any idea that's thrown at you because you've been armed with not only the system of truth and right thinking, you've been armed with the way to think rightly about these things. And that kind of intellectual systematic order for the sake of contemplating the highest truths so that one can live the good life is the primary and ultimate end of all education.
Yeah, I mean, the great intellectual saints of the history of the church, part of what was so great about them is they were so unafraid. You know, Augustine, Augustine was a man who spent his whole life arguing with people, but he was unafraid. When he committed himself to being a little one, that was what really cultivated his ability to then say, okay, now I'm going to dispute with the pagans, with the Pelagians. I mean, Aquinas, the Summa is a tour de force in intellectual courage, but that courage is grounded in confidence. I know that the truth is fundamental, and so I don't need to be afraid of other views because I can learn from them sometimes and also refute them at other times, such that my interlocutor, with whom I'm disagreeing, might come say, huh, you know, actually, this account is the better one, that Christianity and life in the church is the truest and best life possible in this life. You know, don't be afraid.
Right. And, you know, Terrence, I was contemplating this one thing some days ago, that part of why we don't know how to appreciate good art anymore is because we have lost sight of sound education. And I'd love to continue conversations like this with you in the future, Terrence. Thank you so much for joining us on the program. My guest, Terrence Sweeney, assistant teaching professor in the Honors Program in Humanities Department at Villanova University. His work centers on Augustine, but extends to medieval thought, philosophical theology, and political theology. I'm Marcus Peter for Cresta in the Afternoon.
Cresta in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo.
Learn and spread the word about the food, clothing, parenting classes, financial assistance that these resource centers provide moms, and not just for a few weeks after the baby is born, but often for up to 4 years after birth. Don't assume that just because you haven't heard about pro-life resources or efforts that they don't or aren't available, or that the church hasn't been involved. The media, and I know this firsthand from my years of experience, have been working with the abortion industry to suppress information about resources, as well as totally misrepresent or blatantly lie about what the pro-life community offers moms and families in need. And last but not least, do some homework and prayerfully give thanks to these pro-life warriors and consider becoming a pro-life warrior yourself.
Catholic Connections, Teresa Tomeo. Weekdays, 9 a.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
CMF Curo is a Catholic healthcare ministry providing families nationwide with a better solution centered around whole health, spirit, mind, and body. Our members share their medical burdens within a faith-filled community. At CMF Curo, our members have access to a spiritual director, concierge services, and other health and spiritual resources. Find out if CMF Curo is a better solution for your family. Visit MyCatholicHealthcare.com. That's MyCatholicHealthcare.com.
Good afternoon. Welcome back to Cresta in the Afternoon, rounding off this hour of today's program. Through those intriguing conversations, we come to the great conclusion that the transcendence of the gospel of Jesus Christ and the truth of the Catholic faith is supreme in relation to all human cultures and sciences. The Church has a vocation to take all that is good in whatever it roots itself in, but its fruition is in the great potential of the gospel itself. There is no great cultural heritage that is greater than the heritage of divine revelation that we have received from Jesus Christ. So we don't borrow the way of syncretism. Instead, we root people grounded in the fullness of truth found in Christ and His Church. And to that end, we continue to ponder the mysteries of the universe by borrowing all that is true, good, and beautiful from the natural sciences. Until next time, I'm Marcus Peter for Cresta in the Afternoon.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. To follow up on any of the guests or information presented on today's program, visit the Cresta Guest Archive at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMaria Radio.net. To listen to this or any other edition of Cresta in the Afternoon, visit the audio archives at AveMariaRadio.net. Or to order a CD of the program, call 734-930-4506 or email orders at AveMariaRadio.net. That's 734-930-4506 or orders at AveMariaRadio.net.